On this show, I'm talking with Michael Howard about his new book, which documents his funny, confusing, and sometimes frustrating experiences in working for a Japanese company. Welcome to another episode of the Tokyo Podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Cho. And on today's show, I'm going to be talking with author Michael Howard about his new book titled The Salaryman, An American Dude Becomes a Tokyo White-Collar Warrior. And it's a book about his experiences of working at various Japanese companies here in Japan. Now, longtime listeners of the show will know that I am not a huge fan of the Japanese work culture at all. And in fact, it was one of the reasons why I originally left Japan a couple years ago and moved back to Canada. I think I covered that in a few episodes ago. I can't remember what the number is now. But see, the thing is, I was actually pretty lucky in Japan is that I was never a full-time employee. I was always a contractor. In America, the difference between a full-time employee and a contractor may not be a huge difference, but in Japan, it's a really big deal. When you're a full-time employee, I think it's what they call a seishin here. If I'm wrong, someone tell me. But if you're a full-time employee, then basically, you are dedicated to that company for life. And it's one of those deals where the company can't really fire you. And it's that famous lifetime employment that I'm sure many of you have heard about. So when you become a full-time employee of a company, it's like you're committing your life to this company because they will take care of your housing and your family and all things like this. They'll take care of your whole life, give you a nice, comfortable, easy life as long as you dedicate your whole working career to this one company. And a lot of Japanese love this idea. They love this idea of just being taken care of by this big Japanese company and not have any risk or any worries in their life. If you're a contract employee like I was, Japanese company can eliminate your contract at any given time. So there's a lack of security there, but there's more freedom. So for me, I liked it because I like the freedom. But for a lot of Japanese, they don't like it because they want the security of working for an established Japanese company. So anyways, my guest today, Michael, he was a full-time employee and he worked as a full-time employee for a number of different Japanese companies. And the interesting thing is, if you read his book, you're probably going to be thinking like, why the hell this guy stay in Japan this long? Because it's just so funny. And you know what? If you've never worked in Japan, some of the situations that he writes about in his book, you probably are scratching your head. Like, is that real? Like the time that HR told him that he was tearing the toilet paper wrong in the men's washroom.
I got a note from my boss who said, facilities said, hey, Michael is tearing the toilet paper messy. Can you talk to him?
Yeah. Could you imagine having to go to work every day and having to be careful how you tear the toilet paper? That is life in a Japanese company. But the thing is, Michael originally didn't start off in Japan. He was actually working in Los Angeles for a small software company and that had a few clients in Japan. So he would make business trips over here to check on the clients and make sure everything was okay. And it was on one such trip that a friend mentioned to him that he knew of a Japanese company that was looking to hire a foreign executive. And this is actually a big red flag for anyone who's thinking about coming over here. If you see or interview at like a Japanese company in Japan and the whole company's all Japanesey, like there's no other foreigners and they want to hire just one foreigner, you should be very careful because you have to wonder why they want to hire you. Most likely they want to hire you because they just want the novelty of having a foreigner within the company. It may not have to do with your actual qualifications. Be careful about that. But anyways, so Michael decided, you know what? Yeah, I enjoy coming to Japan for my business trips. It might be interesting to kind of live over here. It's very pleasant. And he basically made the same mistake I did when I moved here from Thailand to Japan is we both thought that, yeah, visiting Japan is very nice. It must be the same when you decide to work here. Oh boy, were we ever wrong. But anyways, yeah, Michael went for the interview and he ended up getting the job. And that's when his introduction to the Japanese way began with the company not telling him what his actual job description would be.
Yeah, it was very vague. They were just keen on the idea of the idea of having a foreigner rather than what they were going to do with him once they got him or her. So it was classic. It was a very traditional Japanese company that had no experience hiring foreigners, and the job description was unwritten. Basically, it was more about just like personal connections that got me into the job, and those don't usually go well when you're hired for those reasons rather than like them understanding your resume. And so it was very, the warning signs were there. And being young at the time, I didn't quite recognize those warning signs, but I also recognized that if things went wrong, I was comfortable enough with the idea of being back in Japan with the Japanese wife at that time of making another step to a different company if I had to.
Right. Okay. So you were prepared, obviously, for a change of work environment. You knew it wasn't going to be Silicon Valley, and you kind of had an expectation, I imagine, of a more serious, more traditional type of work environment.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
But would you say, like, looking back now, do you think you were actually prepared for the reality of working in a Japanese company?
No, of course not. Of course not. Yeah, you think you're, the reality of it is you just cannot anticipate the boredom that sets in of the ambiguity of your job responsibilities and just the lack of thought that went into hiring you and everything that it takes as far as manners, politeness, understanding of Japanese helps, and all those things don't really set in until you're like sitting there for 60 hours a week in a Japanese office.
My feeling is, in my experience, is like what I theorize is that a lot of people in companies, like Japanese companies, don't really know what they're doing, especially managers don't know what they're doing. So they kind of like latch on to a few things that make it look like they know what they're doing. I think you mentioned that in the book with the guy who, I can't remember who he was. He's the guy who made you guys like, he's the guy who gave you crap for like showing up 3 minutes late.
The RoboCop?
Yeah, RoboCop guy. Like he didn't know what he was doing. So he tries to like latch onto something to make it look like he knows what he's doing. I've seen this before. Like some people like to have lots of meetings. Some people like to have like have their staff give them reports or whatever it is that makes them look like they're working. Is something that they do to try to mask the fact that they don't have a clue what they're doing.
Yeah, like the episode with the RoboCop where he yelled at me for not texting him, not calling him when I was going to be 3 minutes late to the office.
Right.
Because I had to get off the train to go to the men's room. And I said, hey, if I had stopped to call you, I would have been later. Like, I didn't call you because a train came. And I could get here faster if I got on that train rather than called you. And he goes, no, late is late. Most important is call me.
Right. Right.
I just said, that's nutty. That doesn't make sense. Like you just said, and it didn't vibrate at all with him.
That's kind of funny. It's interesting how you kind of wrote about the motainai mindset in companies because like, you know, motainai, the principle of motainai is something that I like. Like, I like this idea of not wasting things. You know, in theory, it sounds really great. And, you know, companies will do motainai in certain ways. Like I said, I think one of your offices, what was the deal with the printer and the copy machine?
No. Yeah, the printer and the copy machine. It was cheaper to print something. No, it was cheaper to copy something than print something. So they wanted you to, if you had to like make 30 copies of something, they wanted you to print it once, take it out, and then copy it 30 right. times, which is like three steps to save like 10 yen per piece of paper.
So it's funny to me that they had like this mindset of motainai and really small, petty things like that. But then if you look at so many Japanese companies, they're so inefficient in so many other ways. It just boggles my mind that they can be kind of like so picky about small things like this and so, you know, like ignorant to like the larger issue that the company's facing.
Yeah. Yeah, that was true. And again, though, it feeds into like being able to show you can that you're busy and productive. I think it does feed into the motainai or like nitpicking on little things. It's easier to show activity and productivity when you're talking about little things, little details like I just described, than the big picture things, which require confrontation, analysis, confronting uncomfortable inefficiencies, right, and maybe questioning your superiors.
Logical thinking, planning, all those kinds of things.
Yeah.
I find that my feeling is the Japanese culture is like, it's really important to show that you're really genki about something. Like you're really, to show that you're really doing something. And that's more important than if you're actually doing it well or not.
Yeah. I had to learn this kind of thing. I learned in the book, I talk about the driver's license test, and the reason I kept failing getting my driver's license in Japan was I wasn't showing enough effort.
Yeah.
I was driving smoothly. I was making all the turns correctly on this little driving course, but the examiner was insulted that I wasn't going like, hi, hi. Like each time I did something right, he wanted to see like me going, hi, do I show? Yeah. Or like, hi, like, he wanted a packaging to the whole thing, like a wrapping around my obedience.
It's almost like an over-exaggeration is what they want.
Yeah. It's just like the baseball players showing, when they're doing something. He wanted that. And I hadn't learned those mannerisms at that time, like how to end each sentence with a snappy hi or whatever they wanted, and I hadn't learned those little immigrant tricks to impressing the rule makers.
How did you start to learn those kind of things as you're working here? Was there like, did you have like a senpai kohai relationship with someone? Did some older gaijin take you aside and say, hey, this is what you got to do? Or was it just trial and error? Or how did that go about?
I had some good senpai, actually. This, I brought it out. I try to bring it out in the book a little bit. When you get down to a personal level, people are people, I find, in any country. And some people in the companies would just take me aside and say, hey, Mike-san, this is what you got to do. And I had this very good senpai-kohai relationship with several people in Japan who, like, for example, if I questioned in an uncomfortable manner the way the company was messaging its products and its positioning on its website in English, I would tend to be like, hey guys, I used to be a journalist. I was a professional writer. Why don't you just give me this job of writing this is awful. I said it in those terms, the way that, like, they had these taglines on the company website that were just embarrassing, like synergy for the leverage, difference is the difference. And I was like, guys, I was a journalist, did you read my resume? I said it like that way. Yeah. Very, a little insulting, a little snotty, I have to admit. And then later on, somebody took me aside, my senpai actually was in the room, and he said, Mike son, you know, you're right. Everybody knew you're right. But it's the way you said it that just made people uncomfortable. So people do take you for, you know, grab your elbow and say, here's the way to do things on the side. I think that was part of my experience at every stop.
You know, I, as much as we make fun of it, I do think there is some validity to that mindset of being careful how you deliver your message. You know, and I've never worked in corporate America, so I wouldn't know, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's maybe a little bit too casual over there. And maybe Japan is on the other extreme, maybe it's too rigid. But it's something I've been kind of aware of myself, even how I deliver my message is, you know, when you see something that's so obvious like that, you just want to say to them, like what you just said, like, why the hell are you going to get me to do it? You know what I mean? But I could see how, I think if I've learned anything in Japan, I could see maybe softening the message might be a little bit better than just being so blunt about it.
Yeah. And I believe me, I've gone through, it's been years now, since I worked in a Japanese company, and I thought about these situations where the bluntness made people uncomfortable, and I think some of it comes down to a distrust of specialists that exists here. The Japanese culture doesn't have a tradition. The Japanese business culture doesn't have a tradition of specialists. You don't hire consultants to come in and like tell you what's wrong with your business here. That is definitely not part of the culture. And even with me in a Japanese company being the only native English speaker, I was still distrusted in my English ability there. The website example, for example, they still would let this older vice president who spoke very good English but wasn't native like decide everything that went on the English website. And I was like, that's nonsense, guys. And I challenged that. And it was just sort of like, okay, they don't really trust the idea that some people can be given a specific task as they're a specialist who's an expert in this field. And that part I wrangled with for a long time is, and I think it comes down to that. It is a distrust of specialists.
Is it a distrust of specialists or a distrust of foreigners? Like if you were a Japanese specialist who specialized in studying English or something like that, do you think it would be a different scenario?
I don't think it'd be that different, actually. I think it comes down to seniority more than...
Yeah, yeah.
If some guy, at that time I was in my early 30s, came back with an MBA, a Japanese came back from an MBA in the US, for example, you know, from an Ivy League school and spoke perfect English, he still would be, you know, eyebrows would be raised if he's sitting there saying, give me the, just let me manage the English stuff, guys, and take this dinosaur who's managing it off the case. That would still get an eyebrow. So I don't play too much of a you know, the foreigner distrust card too much in that situation.
Yeah, I've had experience with that before. Like when I was doing website design, we would like design something for a client, and the website's supposed to be in English. We would send them the copy. They can't read it, so they would translate it into Japanese using like Google Translate or something, and then they would critique the English based on that, based on the Japanese translation. And we were just looking at them like, what are you talking about? Like, you know, what you're looking at doesn't make any sense because you're not even looking at the original English that we created. But, And yeah, it was the same thing within the company. We're all scratching our head. Like, why in the world are a group of Japanese people trying to tell us how to write English? Like they can't even read the English to begin with. So it was all, I was just always kind of chopped it up to just to have a distrust of foreigners because they can't quantify kind of what we're saying is right or wrong. So I think they just feel more trustworthy. Oh yeah, Sato, he speaks English and he's got a high TOEIC score, so we know his English is good. You, we have no idea. That's my theory is.
Yeah, it is true. Like we use a lot of slang they don't understand at times, us Westerners, especially Americans or Canadians. We infuse a lot of slang into our even our business conversations, and they get pretty uncomfortable with that. And that is far off the textbook learning that you get as a Japanese growing up here in Japan. You don't get any of the nuance of, you know, chit chat or the way we converse in business conversations. So I do think a Japanese, to some degree, who has a high TOEIC score, is a little more comfortable for them to hand over some duties because they're not going to be saying like, well, Mike, what does blackballed mean?
Right.
Blackballed means to be excluded from something because they don't understand these terms like this that we throw around that it would take, you know, long English lessons to explain. I think there is that distrust that happens from the casualness, I think, of being American or North American.
Did you feel any kind of distrust like this or suspicion or anything when you first started working for the first company you worked at? Because you said you were the only foreigner in that company, right? So what was your coworkers like when you first started working there?
Yeah, I had a shadow for sure. A guy assigned to me to like follow me around.
Like literally follow you around?
Oh yeah, like he knew my itinerary before I did, and every day. And I remember, like after 8 or 9 months, I finally was able to like schedule a business trip by myself to an R&D center we had in near Kyoto.
Yeah.
And I did it all by myself, and I was like, I'm free. I had the shackles off me. I felt great, like, to not have a shadow for making a little decision like this. And everybody's waiting for me in Kyoto. They're happy to see me. But I remember before I left, my shadow was like, huh? You made that? You're going by yourself? You did that by yourself? And it was like this long silence of like 30 seconds. He sat there and digested that I was on my own. Like, I was the gaijin had the foreigner had taken a step to doing things on his own without somebody helping him. And so that hit me. That was the first year I was here. It hit me. It was like, wow, I'm really not trusted to, like, one, be able to purchase a Shinkansen,
ticket by
bullet
yourself.
Train ticket on my own, let alone they still thought I might, like, divert to Osaka and just, like, have a bender for 2 days instead of go to the R&D center.
Did you find that they kind of relaxed a bit when you started to kind of, hang out after hours? Because so much of Japanese work culture is the after hours drinking parties and drinking, dinner and all that. Did you find that they kind of were a little bit more accepting of you during that time?
Oh, you mean after I spent some time with them?
Yeah. Yeah.
Were they more cool? No, I thought those were diversions. Those on a personal level helped. In my situation, the first job was such a train wreck. It didn't matter, like, that I did those things. I was a kyokushin, a contract worker.
Ah, okay. Yeah.
So I was not a seishin, permanent employee.
Right.
Which is a very different thing. So I don't think I ever had that brotherhood, despite what I did. And I made some good friends personally, but I think on a business level, I was never involved in anything important there at the first 2 years I was here, because I was a kyokushin, right, contract worker.
So were you a full-time employee at some of the other companies you worked at?
Yeah, all the others I was. My ex-wife made sure of that. I learned hard. This is a whole nother theme that would be another podcast, but the Japanese wife expectations for salaryman seishinhood, and what that means to everyday life here. To be a seishin is everything.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I remember when I was working at Gaijinpot was bought out by Fuji Media. And there was a few contract workers. I was one of the contract workers. And there was a couple of Japanese contract workers, some foreigners. And when Fuji took over, they said, we don't want any contract workers. Everyone's going to become full-time. And the foreigners were not too thrilled about it. The Japanese loved the idea. I was so surprised at, like, how excited they were to be bought out by this big Japanese company and made, like, a full-time worker. And the funny thing is, the salary was going to decrease, because you got to pay all this extra tax and all that kind of stuff. And I said to them, like, your salary is going to go down. And then I remember one girl's like, yeah, but have you seen their medical plan? She actually went on their website and, like, looked up their medical plan. I was like, okay, good for you. But yeah, it's funny how they like that.
And seishin, you can't get fired.
Right.
Without going to, like, the highest levels of Japanese government to fire someone.
Yeah.
You'd have to kick your boss down the stairs to get fired as a seishin. And the stability is everything in some people's minds here. I think it is changing for some younger generations, but younger people here in certain fields, I should say.
Yeah.
The seishin mentality, but it still dominates for sure.
Well, one thing I found interesting about your book in that you write about how much Japanese companies are willing to help their employees, especially their male employees, deal with the requirements of their wife, right? You talked about the whole hesokuri, money thing. And I was surprised to see, I didn't realize like it was that extensive. Like the company itself is helping you set up a separate bank account and all that. I thought it was just like the salaryman would do that on the sly. But I didn't realize that the company actually was helping them, you know, set up that whole system. Maybe you can explain a bit to the audience what Hezokuri is.
Oh, it's so institutionalized. It was an eye opener for sure. it really signifies a lot of how I think Japan sort of greases its skids for making life as comfortable as possible for employees for permanent employees to follow all these rules and all this just bureaucracy, red tape, and I think the Hezokuri, the pocket money scheme, and how they support it is just one of many under the table ways companies help you deal with that. Like the Hezokuri concept is basically just, okay, you have expectations as a permanent employee to have dinners, all you can drink dinners, some required, some related to a meeting, some not. All of it requires money, and salaries, of course, famously in Japan are not going up. Deflation for 20 years, and so Hezokuri. When I worked at every Japanese company I worked at, the HR department would happily help you set up a situation where all of your or part of your expenses, your business expenses, would be sent to your secret bank account. They didn't know, you know, they didn't ask if it's secret or not, but it was implied that it was like, okay, you have a second bank account and you just want $100 a month sent there. Is that all? Okay. And you know, they'd have that kind of conversation with you. They'd sit there and line item your expenses and be like, okay, we'll send this much amount of money to your other bank account as opposed to your family bank account, which your wife or husband sees and watches over. And it was a whole subculture. It was like this little game played to very comfortably hide enough money every month in your bank account, your secret bank account, to pay for these. Some were innocent, you know, escapades to just drink with your colleagues, and some were very not innocent, like the book portrays. People took it to another level of like, you know, having thousands of dollars in their secret bank account to pay for whatever you could do in Tokyo to, you know, R-rated, X-rated, as far as you wanted to go with it.
Yeah, I think we should explain kind of how that works in Japan, because how it works in Japan is typically, if you're a traditional married couple, wives generally don't work in Japan, but she handles all the finances. So Michael goes to work, and being a good salary man, he works like 100 hours a week and goes drinking and all that. And then the company sends his paycheck, and basically his wife takes his entire paycheck and gives him an allowance every month. Here, Michael, here's your $300 allowance. Go buy your bento, et cetera, et cetera. So the salary man, that's what they live on for their, you know, daily expenses and food and whatnot, is the allowance that their wife gives them. And so what this Hezokuri thing is, allows them to take some of their business expenses and siphon it off to a separate account that they can then access. So the wife doesn't see. Say you go for dinner and the dinner costs $100. You expense $100 to the company. Well, maybe you're only expensing $80 and the $20 goes into your other secret account. Is that right? Do I got it right?
Yeah, you got it. The perfect summary.
Right. So then the wife doesn't know exactly how much everything costs and allows the salaryman to have this extra fund. And you know, the funny thing is, I had experience with this when I was in Thailand. I was teaching English in Thailand to these Japanese salarymen, and this one guy was hilarious because he got his regular Japanese salary plus an extra bonus salary for being in Thailand, and of course that all went to his wife, and then his wife would send him money. And so what he did was, every time his wife came to visit, he would take her to the most expensive restaurants in Thailand. He would hire a private driver to drive them around, go shopping in the most expensive shopping malls and all that, because he wanted her to think that Bangkok was that expensive. So then she would send him more money and then he'd get all this money. And of course, when she's gone, he'd be eating at like the street food stall. You know, he would be taking like a tuk-tuk, like a regular motorcycle taxi, the cheapest one possible. And all that extra money was spent in like girl bars and golf courses and all this stuff.
Yeah. Oh, the Tanshin Funing culture. Tanshin Funing, I should say, in English, is the it's the culture of employees being sent away from their family to a remote company location by themselves, with company paying for everything, apartment, and like the description you just mentioned, you know, a lifestyle. Inconvenience fee is involved. You'll get like, I got, when I was a Tanshin Funing employee in San Jose, I got like $2,000 a month just for the inconvenience of being sent away from my family to San Jose. My family remained in Tokyo. And a lot of Japanese employees use that money to fund a lifestyle of golf or whatever. And it's amazing that there's this, like this shell game of sort of hiding money that companies are involved in, whether it's Tanshin Funing or Hesokuri, the payment of company expenses to a separate bank account to help you pay for just having fun in Tokyo at bars or whatever. It's just part of the culture here. And that was a real education. My first 6-7 years was understanding the culture of this shell game that happens of hiding money.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think it goes back to what you said earlier. It's like the Japanese companies, they will, you know, go through all these procedures, have all these procedures, have all these kind of hidden accounts and go through all this to protect their workers from just the drudgery of their daily work life, right? Like, I think maybe they know that the bureaucracy and the inefficiency and all that's going to drive anyone bonkers after a while. So to counter that, they, you know, give people this kind of like extra bonuses, so to speak, kind of hush money, so to speak, and have like after work drinking parties and all that. Because otherwise, I think the whole corporate culture would kind of collapse.
Yeah, I mean, I say this half jokingly in the book, but I do have a theory, an economic theory, about how this, what role this plays. And there's so much lost productivity because of all the rules and the manners and everything we've talked about of bureaucracy and inefficiency and what that does to motivation. And I do think there is some degree of truth to, there's two halves. There's the private, there's the salaryman or business woman who is so frustrated motivationally with this, and where does that go? And then after work, that goes to a whole release of frustration privately or with your colleagues. And there's a waiting, just beautiful retail, just living in Tokyo, you know, you're in the Mecca, you're in a Camelot of retail services. Just the service is amazing, the food is amazing, the alcohol is amazing, and you have a little bit of a carte blanche to just be whatever you want to do in one of those bars. The izakaya is there. You can yell from across the restaurant to have them refill your glasses, and a waitress will run over apologetically and fill it. Whereas in LA, you know, she'd throw a hot bowl of soup on your lap for treating her like that. So there's this great, I would say, like just matching of need and environment that happens here. And I think companies recognize that and feed it with some of these things of these games they play with the money and the expense reimbursements.
Yeah, I think you mentioned it as like the invisible hand that guides the Japanese economy, right? Like there's so much loss of productivity and inefficiency. So how does the economy keep ticking over? Because there's just massive consumption on the other side. These people are just, yeah, you know, almost useless at work, barely functional. And like you see, like, you know, you ever see like in Tokyo, like those guys with the construction sites and they're like holding a stick or a wand or something like that, or you just see some dude just standing there. And I always kind of think like, boy, that guy's job could be replaced with a sign, you know, like, you know, just be careful here like that. But there's like a guy standing there. So like I've seen this in companies, or you must have seen 100 times where you go to like a business meeting and like you're there to meet like one or two people. You go to the meeting and there's like 12 people in that meeting. And you're like, why does everybody need to be here? But I think like, yeah, like all that inefficiency gets countered by the massive consumption that these people do outside of after work.
Yeah, it's so true. I mean, boy, some of the things you just said in that little 30-second window there, like we would have a 10-to-1 ratio in every meeting I would have with like U.S. partners and my Japanese companies, 10 Japanese to every one American.
Yeah.
Like it was just a classic. We'd have like 20 Japanese sitting there, you know, and 2 Americans.
Yeah.
Who were like calling the shots, and they'd be like spitting out orders and hard things at us. And they'd be like, oh, something about inefficiency that is very representative of what's going on here. Every time I thought that. And yet at the same time, we'd all go out as 20 of us to a drinking party to bond or talk or just, and whereas those 2 Americans would go home to their families.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
It was just like, there's something very different going on here in the way we approach our jobs between U.S. and Japanese culture.
Yeah. Was there anything that you experienced here? Like if you were to go back to the States, is there any positives that you think you could take if you went back to work for an American company in the States, not here, but in the States?
There's not too many. No, I really, other than personal friends I made on personal levels at every stop I've made. No, the answer is no. Professionally, other than learning Japanese and a lot about the culture, which is valuable, as a business person, no, I really didn't learn very many positives at any of these stops. The management it's a fundamental weakness here, and I think it's well documented. So I didn't really learn much. I really, though, have to say at the same time, I'm conflicted because they helped me through. I became a father during this whole time. I had 2 kids. I was able to increase my salary at each stop. So I'm conflicted about criticizing what happened here because people did buy into me, and they didn't give me roles that ended up having any meaning or anything I could build on. I had to go to an American company to actually be valued for real skills. But at the same time, they gave me some way to here, like establish a life here and like progress my personal life. So personally, I do have a lot. To summarize my responses, personally, I have a lot to thank the experience for, but professionally, no, it really didn't bring me anything that could last, I think, long term, if I went back to a U.S. company.
You know what's interesting is on my previous show, I think it's the last one or the one before, I did a review of some of my favorite movies that are set in Japan. And mm-hmm. one of the movies that I reviewed was a film called, it's a documentary called Tokyo Idols. Have you ever heard of it?
No.
So it's a really great documentary. I recommend anyone checking it out. And it's about the idol culture here in Japan. You know, idols are those young girls are dancing all over the stage and whatnot. Yeah. So it's about this woman, this filmmaker made this film, a documentary about the idol culture. And when I first watched it, when I first saw it, like I saw this poster and I was like, yeah, I'm going to watch this. This is going to be like super cringy. It'll be hilarious. I can make fun of all these geeks, you know, and all that. That's what I thought when I started watching it. But there's a line in this, there's one segment in this movie where they interview this salaryman who quit his job to become like the head of like some fan group of this one particular idol. And what he said in this documentary was, I thought was like so profound. And he said like he was this typical salaryman, took the first job out of university. He said his company provided him a very happy, comfortable, but mediocre life, devoid of any excitement. And I thought, you know what? I bet most Japanese feel that way. And the reason why, interestingly, the reason why he likes these idols isn't so much that he's some kind of like pedophile or anything like that, is that these girls sing about songs about like getting ahead in life and moving forward and meeting your goals and those kind of things. So by him, he's basically trying to live this life that he couldn't have vicariously through this idol. By supporting her, being a fan, he's trying to live through her because he didn't have the guts, I guess, to do that. And really, you can't blame the guy because, as you probably can get, relate to it, it's really comfortable to live in Japan, right? And if you have a good paying job here, there's not a lot of stress besides like the typical Japanese work crap that you have to deal with. It's very, very easy to live and work in Japan.
Oh, yeah. If you don't mind, like, spending time away from your family on Saturdays to go golfing with your boss and say nice shot at the golf course, like that guy in that situation you just described, it is comfortable. And the consumer culture, I argue in the book half jokingly, that maybe it's worth it. It's that good, it's that fun to be a consumer in Japan, like to enjoy the service here and the food and like just the way they treat you and how refined it is and craftsmanship and like, wow. Okay. Yeah. Maybe he has an argument. Maybe it's worth it. It's boring. You boil yourself to tears at times, sitting through it. But at the same time, it's like, wow, it is pretty amazing, isn't it?
That was Michael Howard, author of the book, The Celery Man. Now I'll say one thing is that there are probably a lot of really great Japanese companies to work for. Michael himself has even admitted that the companies that he ended up working for were like seriously hardcore Japanese. And that when he kind of talked to some of his other Japanese friends, they even said like, wow, I wouldn't have never worked for that type of company. So his companies, I think, are, I wouldn't say the exception, because my experience also, you know, there's a lot of companies that kind of operate in a similar fashion, but I would say kind of more extreme end of the Japanese way of doing business, put it that way. So, you know, don't be afraid to come over here and work for a Japanese company, because you may have a different experience than what Michael and I have had. But honestly, I wouldn't be surprised if it's quite similar. And one thing you should be aware of if you're thinking about coming to Japan to work, I covered this in the Tokyo Podcast episode, season 2, number 5 or 6, I can't remember, where I said, how old is too old to move to Japan? And I kind of broke down, if you're in your 20s, 30s, or 40s, what can you expect if you move to Japan? And I will say this, like, if you're in your 20s, I would be really cautious about coming to Japan and how much time you spend here. Because like Michael said, very little of his work experience here could transfer back to his home country. And because, like he said, like many times, you're not really given a specific set of tasks here. You're just kind of generic floating around. They kind of give you assignments every now and then, and you're not really growing in your career here. It's not done in Japan, because they don't really think about like changing companies or moving up in their career. They're just happy to have whatever job that the company assigns them. So if you're coming over here to kind of like in your 20s, and you know, it's very easy to come here and then like stay for like 10 years or so, and then suddenly you're like 35 and you're like, crap, should I stay here or should I go back to America? And you go back and you realize like, wow, none of the job skills that you developed here are really beneficial for you back home. So I would really encourage anyone who's thinking about coming here when you're young to really be mindful of how much time you spend here, because you spend too much time here and you're basically stuck here, and then it's all downhill from there. Then you're out salary man every night drinking and got your comb over and, you know, sleeping on the train and whatnot. But it definitely is an interesting look into the Japanese corporate world here. And I actually have another guest lined up who I will be interviewing in a couple weeks from now, who kind of paints a little bit of a different picture, because his whole job is teaching foreigners how to work with the Japanese. So I'm really looking forward to that interview. He spent 30 years in Japan, so I'm looking forward to that interview to kind of see maybe where some areas that Michael and I could improve on to work better with the Japanese. But anyways, that wraps up this episode of Tokyo Podcast. Thanks for listening, everybody. I'm your host, Anthony Joe, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye. You know, the funny thing is when I picked up your book, and I started laughing at the first sentence in your book. And I want to read this because it's just, it's so funny and it's so relatable to what I've gone through. And your first sentence in your book, it says, I sat sweating in a bright, stuffy meeting room on the top floor of a towering Shubia office tower. The room was at least 5 degrees hotter than any Western male could take. And I have been in that exact situation so many times. For those of you who've never been to Japan this summer, it is brutal. It, think of like 30 plus degrees, 80% humidity. And what I found is my experience is like, I'm, you know, you go into a meeting with a client or any kind of office meeting. The office is so hot and so stuffy. They usually don't turn the air conditioning on. So I'm sitting in there, the only gaijin, just sweating like crazy. And the Japanese are perfectly fine. And then they look at me like, are you hot? And I'm like, bless you, lizard. It's like a 35 degrees in your office. Like, what do you expect? And they're like, oh, okay. Maybe we should turn on the air conditioning. But God, did I ever find that funny?